Craig Hoffman.
But you know the TikTok is like, I'm alive, I'm dead. That one?
Yeah.
The Hoffman Show.
That's how I felt all day. I'm just like, I'm alive, I'm dead.
On the Team 980 and the Odyssey app.
It's the Hoffman Show. Hour number two here on the Team 980. Always live as well on the free Odyssey app. And actually, Metal Chris, who's in today for Anthony. Anthony, I can happily report, by the way, Anthony has made it safe to Paris. He is on the ground. He has also changed his name. He's been there for like 30 minutes, and he's changed his name to Antoine. So we'll check in with Haney when he gets back and see what his name is. But anyway, Metal Chris, are you prepared to hit the Not My Beat stinger? And if not, we'll just go straight to Kareem. It's not a big deal because I forgot to remind you. Tell you what. It's all good. That's my fault. I own that. So, Kareem Copeland, Washington Post. I'm sorry you don't get the fancy introduction, but your piece was awesome. I'm excited to talk to you about it.
I appreciate you having me.
All good, man. All good. All right. So, you wrote a piece on WNBA officiating, which, for those of us that have been watching the WNBA for a long time, is something that has needed more attention for a long time. It is now getting a lot of attention. How is the league reacting to the increased scrutiny of what has been inconsistent at best, or maybe at worst, as you wrote about officiating in its games?
It's actually kind of funny. They acknowledge that, hey, we're not perfect, and they talk a lot about, hey, we've got young refs coming in. They're coming through this pipeline that, hey, before they even hit a WNBA floor, there's 6 to 10 years in our pipeline and all these things. But it's funny you use the word consistency, and that seems to be the biggest divide between the two groups when you're talking about players and coaches and the league. The league thinks the consistency word is a bit of a cop-out, or at minimum, misunderstood. I was talking to Monty McCutcheon, who's kind of in head of officiating. He's developed development and training for all of the NBA leagues, which are, we're talking G League, we're talking WNBA, we're talking about NBA. And he was saying, listen, there's a difference between consistency and fair. And a lot of coaches get upset when so-and-so, you know, there's a free throw discrepancy. They've shot 20 free throws, we've only shot five. Things aren't consistent. He says that, listen, that's a fair issue, not a consistency issue. The consistency issue should be, hey, are we calling the same calls the exact way? Are we applying the rules the exact way at the same time? He believes that's more of what we're hearing with consistency. And they chuckle a little bit because they're like, listen, we've been hearing this complaint for years. At the same time, I talked to Nafis Collier the other day, and she says she thinks it's getting worse. And so there's this divide between the way the two groups kind of view what's going on right now. But the league acknowledges that it's a thing, that they want to get better. And, you know, the big thing that they kept saying is, you know, observed, educated, and held accountable. Those are the three things that all their refs have to kind of go through. And so my kind of question is, you know, the kind of held accountable part, because we haven't seen a whole lot of that, or it's not publicly announced when, you know, when someone, I don't want to say the word disciplined, but is held accountable from the official standpoint. But then you kind of go back to the big fracas the other day between the Fever and the Sun, and, you know, the next day they're upgrading technicals and Angel Reese's hair gets pulled and it gets called just a regular common foul. And those are like the things that we as fans see and say, you know, that just can't right. That's not right and doesn't make sense. And so I think that's where this kind of discord is kind of happening. So there's a hope that they're on the right path and that they are going to stick to their guns and do what they say as far as holding folks accountable. But from our side of things, you know, we kind of just got to watch because those things aren't exactly publicized. And so you just kind of go game by game and kind of cross your fingers each game and see how things are going to be officiated.
When it comes to the quality standpoint, Kareem, I get to use my one of my favorite journalism quotes 2 days in a row on the show. I was using it with Eric Flack yesterday. You get it today. If one side says it's raining, or one person says it's raining, and someone else says it's not, our job is ultimately to go outside and find out. When you look at the quality of WNBA officiating, as someone who has watched this league as a fan at first and now covered this league for a number of years now, do you think the quality is, A, worrisome, and then, B, to Nafisa Collier's point, do you think it's actually getting worse?
I'm not sure if it's getting worse, but I do think it's a thing. I do think it's a thing that when you watch, quite frankly, the NBA, that you feel like there's different, that there's not as many issues on that side. I would say even, you know, we're talking about the debut, but I would venture to go to the NCAA level also. It just feels like there's more, as much as they hate the word, inconsistency on the women's side than there is on the men's side. And I would also venture that probably can trace that back a little bit to the fact of the way the salary structures are set up. When you're in the NBA, you're fully salaried. You can only work for the NBA. That's it. That's your full-time job. On the women's side with the W, you get paid, let's, for example, I was talking to an official, and this was the example he gave me. You can get paid $2,000 per game with expenses from the WNBA. But say you're refereeing an SEC game, you get paid $5,000 a game, but without your expenses. So if you're trying to make this your profession, you're going to naturally, and I would say the most talented people would gravitate towards a more stable financial situation where, number one, you're fully salaried, and number two, this is all I've got to do. I don't have to do something else during, I don't have to have a side job. I don't necessarily have to do college games during the winter, all of these kind of things. I think I got off on a little bit of a different tangent, but point being, I do think there's a lot to clean up on the women's side. And I think the fact that it's gotten, the game right now is just getting more attention than ever, that there's a lot more eyeballs out there witnessing it. So the conversation is getting a lot louder. And quite frankly, that does put a little bit more pressure on the league.
Kareem Copeland, reporter, Washington Post, with us here on the Hoffman Show. The reporting you did in talking to an actual official, to me, is what set this piece apart from, let's say, my griping about it over the years. Because I can also be like, hey, here's this press conference clip, and with my own eyes, I think it stinks. This reporting, I thought, was so interesting because it opens up a real question, Kareem, which is, can the WNBA afford, is a silly term here in a way, because it's both directly on the nose, monetarily, literally afford, but I also mean this in a less literal sense. Can they afford to have full-time officials in a league that just spans the summer, right? The WNBA tips off in, April is when training camps open. They tip off in May. They're done by October. Do they just expect referees not to take other jobs the rest of the year? Like, and by the way, before anyone's like, well, they do it in the NBA, the NFL does not have full-time officials. So for leagues that have limited calendars, this is a problem across sports. So can the WNBA, within the both the financial and that kind of time constraint context, afford to have full-time officials? How would that work?
I think that's the big question, and even the official that I was that I talked to was kind of pointing out to that same thing, said, hey, if you pay me right, you know, I'll give up all that other stuff and I can completely focus on this, because it also affects officials when you're going back and forth from the college game to the WNBA game. You have to kind of adjust a little bit because they're different games, there's different requirements, so you kind of have to adjust. And he was saying, listen, there's people who don't adjust very well. There's people who are used to this college system, and then when it comes summertime and it's time to be in a pro mind frame, that they don't necessarily switch the same way. And so that's the big thing. Like, when we talk about the financials, you know, you said can they afford it? That's the question, you know. But we've got a big new $2.2 million media deal coming up. The CBA is being negotiated as we speak. And so that's kind of the next question, is how are they going to where and how are they going to apply these new funds? And does some of that go into officiating or address officiating or make that a more lucrative and stable situation for your officials, so you might not be losing the best of the best to the NBA, or you might not be losing the best to the best to people who decide, hey, if I just do my college games and I can do more games on that level and I can make technically game to game more money, and, you know, depending on how they arrange their travel and their meals and their hotels, you know, if you can arrange it where you can still make more money on those games, it makes the W less attractive. So that becomes the question that, quite frankly, isn't answered right now as they negotiate the new CBA. And, you know, we're less than, you know, what? They just announced the new media deal, what, 6 months ago, if that? So we're still trying to see how this new windfall of cash is going to be divvied out and how it's long-term going to affect the league. But every year, you know, they're adding more games, they're adding more teams, and so there's more attention and more eyes, and there's going to be more games on TV. So as people watch more closely, you're going to have to – we were talking about being held accountable. They're going to be held accountable to have better officiating. And so that's the big question that we're all kind of waiting to see.
What's the current relationship between, on an officiating front, between the WNBA, the NBA, and the G League, and the resources that are available from a training perspective and even a potential to cross games and have officials get extra reps and be able to work within a similar system, NBA to G League to W? Is there crossover? What's the relationship?
Well, essentially, the whole system is set up where they identify people, you know, young officials at lower levels, whether it's camps or maybe levels of NCAA or whatever. And so we start bringing you in the pipeline. And at that point, they get training, they get developed, they go out and they're still out working. But like the next step is they call it grassroots, where you kind of get in this program where you're doing summer camps, like the Boo Williams camp that they have here close to D.C. in the DMV. They start putting them in those kind of camps and watching them, like, grow and learn and get used to things. And then a certain amount of them kind of get up to the next level, where I think it's called the NBA Players Association has a top 100 camp each year.
Yep, so then just happened. It's part of the NBA draft process. It literally happened a month ago.
Absolutely. So you go there and you start to, you know, you continue to grow and show who you are, and they evaluate you. And then, you know, they trim the list down even more. And so then at that point, you finally get to the point where you can work some G League games. And G League, essentially, G League and Summer League is kind of your training ground for those that go on to the WNBA and the NBA. Now, remember, the NBA, once you get to the NBA, you can't work any other league. You are contracted to that. You've got a full salary. You can only work NBA games. Not the same way for the W, because you can also still work college and still work other things during the off season. So that's kind of where you – that's kind of the process. And, again, going back to McCutchen, he insisted that the WNBA is not a feeder league to the NBA. And I was talking to Eric Thibault, the old Mystics coach, who's now associate coach for the Lynx, and that was the question that he had. He said the league has to decide at some point whether this is the destination for officials or is this another step along the road. And so obviously there's a disconnect between coaches, players, and what the league sees as that, because they certainly don't feel like the officials are coming to the W as a destination, and the league is saying, no, it is a destination. However, the flat-out financials makes it where it can't be your only destination, even if that is your destination.
Right. That just feels like insulting to our collective intelligence, with all due respect to the league office. Like, one's a salary job, one's not. Like, how, do you want the job with the guarantees and benefits, or do you want the freelance gig? Like, what are we even talking about here? And that's, like, in fairness to the league, on the other side of that, again, you're dealing with half the game. So, to me, it feels like there should almost be, like, a W G League level and then an NBA level. And also, in fairness to the reality of the games, right? NBA players, if you were to put stopwatches on them, etc., are faster. The game is faster. It is harder to officiate the NBA game than the W game. That said, the style of play in the W and the accepted amount of physicality, like legal physicality, that has been a hallmark of that league, makes it very, very difficult to officiate. So I don't, like, to me, that's a bunch of relevant information. I don't know what to do with it, but what I do know now, Kareem, is that it's clearly not working. Are there, like, have you found people that you're like, oh, that's a good idea? Or is this all, are all the negotiations really being kept in house behind the scenes, if they're even happening at all?
It seems being kept in house for the most part, but just kind of along my reporting, you know, there's just certain things that everybody's kind of pointing out that's like, hey, we need to figure out, you know, what physicality we're going to allow. You know, there was a point coming into the season that freedom of movement, I was talking to the current Mystic coach, Sidney Johnson. He said, hey, freedom of movement was supposed to be an emphasis this year, and people are getting grabbed and knocked down and slowed up. And, you know, if you go into the paint in the WNBA game, oh my goodness, you know, it is rough down there. And even going back to your comparison to NBA, they are two different styles of officiating, I would say, because of the two different styles of games and things you got to look out for and things like that. A big thing that people talked about is communication. Like, hey, some people do a very good job of communicating with a coach, with coaches and players, and that can head off a lot of this, a lot of the issues that arise. And some people just quite frankly aren't. And that would sounded like, one of the things that kind of pop up more with people who go back and are really good at or officiate a lot of college games, because it seems like you give a little bit more leeway to college coaches, because if a college coach gets on your bad side and then they report you to the league, then you can eventually get held out of, you know, premier games. And so that affects your paycheck. Whereas when you're on the pro game, listen, you should be able to, it's all kind of about keeping control of the game. And if you don't have good communication, things get out of whack real quick. Just that, you know, we keep coming back to that Fever Sun game. I think that's what it was. You know, you didn't have control of the game. And that's the thing that everybody kind of points out. The refs are supposed to have control of the game. And on the different levels, there seems to be a distance when that happens and how much physicality they're allowing, the calls that they're making between a common foul, a technical, a flagrant one, because we saw in that it's, you know, all of a sudden they had to go back the next day and adjust this. Okay, we're going to make this a flagrant too. We're going to fine so-and-so. So when you have to kind of go back the next day and start adjusting things, that means things weren't called the right way on the floor in the first place. So I think all of this stuff is definitely being talked about behind the scenes, but, you know, they're going to try to keep that stuff as in-house as possible.
All right, last one real quick is just as a basketball person covering the league. Like, we've mentioned the Suns Fever fracas a couple times. Do you think they eventually got that right? Because I was not thrilled with how the penalties ended with that one. What did you make, before I tell you what I think, what did you make of what ultimately came of that hullabaloo?
I mean, you eventually, I didn't have any issues with the way they finally kind of got it, but I mean, I feel like it's easy to come or turn around the next day and change the things, but you had already let it get out of control on the floor in the first point. That's the way I looked at it, is that you had to get control of the game before you got to the point where I'm going, oh my gosh, I'm going blank. Where Sophie is essentially, you know, right, putting somebody in a headlock. You know what I'm saying? Like, that is the culmination of an entire game of things not being called or things being allowed to be more physical than it needs to be. That's kind of the way that I'd look at it. Now, you know, how Mabry doesn't get more than just a technical or whatever I think it was a technical that they originally called on her when she ran up on Caitlin and knocked her to the floor, and then the next day they upgraded it to a flagrant two, and then they're like, yeah, she should have been ejected. Well, you know, that kind of stuff needs to happen in the moment, not in the next day. And so of course, that's why people are all riled up and taking little shots at each other and digs at each other throughout the game. Because, you know, we know people are going to defend their teammates and defend their stars. And if you let somebody just run up and knock them to the floor with barely any consequence, all right, this is how it's going to go today. This is how we're going to play. All right. And all of a sudden, you're losing control of the game. So that's whatever they kind of end up, you know, the things and the adjustments and the fines the next day, that's not so much of my concern, because I want you to have control of the situation in the moment. And the official that I talked to, he was like, yeah, they completely blew that. That whole situation was horrible. Should have never got to that point because they blew the calls in the very first place.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there was stuff leading up to it. Unpopular opinion, especially amongst very certain loud parts of the internet that let me know about it. I thought they got it right on the floor. I thought that, like, Caitlin was distracted. I'm not going to say, like, she flopped. She was distracted by the fact that she got poked in the eye and Mabry, like, bumped her and she went down really easy. And, like, that's
a little bit more than a bump.
I thought she went down easy. I didn't think that had to be a flagrant two. I thought Cunningham should have been suspended because we don't tackle people in basketball. That was ridiculous. But that's just my personal opinion. If you wanted to throw Mabry out because, like, she clearly escalated, I'm fine with that. But the Cunningham thing, not getting suspended for tackling someone and then looking to immediately start a fight, that can't happen. All right. Kareem Copeland, Washington Post. He does real reporting, and you can read it in the Washington Post, washingtonpost.com/sports. Kareem, thanks for your time. As always, my friend, have a great weekend, and I'll see you at ESA or Care for Serena soon.
Absolutely, homie. Thank you. Appreciate you having me, though.
Absolutely. Kareem Copeland with us here on The Hoffman Show. When we get back, football. Who's got the best defensive line in the NFC East? That was a debate we had on the Take Command podcast. Myself, Logan Paulson, you'll hear it next before we discuss more on the Ace Bailey situation and why it is worth discussing beyond just like, oh, it's really weird that he didn't want to, you know, oh, hey, is he a bad kid for not wanting to go to Utah? There's a lot more to it than that, and we'll get there coming up at 6 o'clock on The Hoffman Show. It's The Hoffman Show. We're on the Team 980. We are always live as well on the free Odyssey app, streaming live on YouTube too, at the Team 980. Thanks again to Kareem Copeland, who just joined us. If you missed it, search The Hoffman Show wherever you get your podcast, later on tonight or this weekend, and it'll be sitting there waiting for you. Same with our chat with Zach Harper an hour ago on the NBA. Right now, though, speaking of podcasts, Take Command. If you haven't had a chance to listen to our NFC East positional group rankings, we rank the DBs, the linebackers, and the defensive backs across all four teams in the NFC East. Where do the Commanders stack up on the D-line? That's where we started, Logan Paulson and I. We always let you hear a little bit of Take Command here on the show. And it's about that time right now.
It's time to Take Command with former NFL tight end Logan Paulson and former Commanders beat reporter Craig Hoffman.
What's up? What's happening? Welcome in. It's the Take Command podcast. Craig Hoffman here. Logan Paulson there. Happy Thursday, everybody. It is time to rank defensive football players in groupings within the NFC East. I'm just
well
like,
done.
How
good on how, that intro, man. That
yeah. How many words can I say to say what we're doing? It's our NFC East positional group rankings. This time the defense edition. And it's so funny how we have the same epiphany every year. And it's like, oh, we should also do. Oh, wait, we did that last year. Next week on this show, so the late week show, of course, our mailbag will be early in the week. We're going to rank the coaches in the NFC East. We did that last year. It goes very well. Nobody gets mad. And we do it perfectly. And so we're going to do head coaches, OCs, DCs next week. So look forward to that. But for today, the defense, Logan. And we're going to start along the defensive line. We'll hit the linebackers and then get back into the secondary. And I think this is interesting when you look at these defensive lines in this division, because I feel like there's a couple that have like big potential upside, but also some low floor, including the Commanders. You have an Eagles team that's still very good and arguably has the best player in the division in Jalen Carter. But they also lost a lot of depth and they're maybe second best guy on that line in Milton Williams, certainly best second or second best interior player. And then you have the Giants, who everyone is sad if you're in New York after the offensive rankings, but your D-line's really, really good.
Yeah, and, very good.
I actually think we might have a Giants logo at the top of the graphic here. But where are you at with where you want to start with the defensive line groups in this division?
Yeah, this was a really tough process, you know, kind of like looking through your notes, looking at sack production, looking at players, looking at kind of, and trying to distinguish like pedigree, because I think you brought it up with Philly. Like, I look at Jalix Hunt, right, who was not an overly productive player last year, and like, he had moments of flash, and I think the last two games, specifically the playoff run, he looked really, really good. But if you kind of look prior to that, he was kind of, I don't want to say middling, because I think he's a good player, but like, he's still a developmental edge rusher, like Nolan Smith, still a developmental edge rusher, right? So even though they're these big names, right, and like, when you look at like Philadelphia's offseason camp, like, everyone's talking about how good Jalix Hunt looks, how he's going to take on this pass rushing role, blah, blah, but he hasn't done it yet, right? So even Nolan Smith, I think Nolan Smith is a really good run player. I think he's a good football player, but like, in terms of adding pass rush, like, which unit's going to be the most dominant? And then you've got Jalen Carter. They lost Milton Williams. So I think that's like a sneaky loss, because like, when you go back and watch games, like, he's not as disruptive, but he's a disruptive element to that group. So I didn't really know where to lie with this. So ultimately, like, I think if I had to like gun to my head, like, the group that I'm most afraid of right now, and again, where do we, January, whatever the date is, June 24th.
You know what's cool about January 24th? I think the Commanders were still playing in the playoffs at that point.
That's pretty wild, isn't it?
Which is cool.
Yeah. So I think the one for me that sticks out is probably the New York Giants. Like, I just think about Brian Burns last year. He had a really good year. 10 sacks. He had 46 hurries last year, which is incredible. Dexter Lawrence, you mentioned Jalen Carter. Dexter Lawrence might be the best player in the division, like, full stop.
Yes.
Which is a crazy conversation to be having about a nose guard. And I think when you look at his first, was it 8, 9 games, maybe 10 games, he was the best player in the NFL. And obviously he cooled as the year went on, but like, that's the kind of talent you're talking about. And that's not like long time ago. That was last year. He was one of the more dominant players in the division. I think he had close to 10 sacks. Kayvon Thibodeau's never been super productive, but you bring in the first pick, or what is he, the first pick overall, right, in edge rusher, right? Second pick?
Third pick,
right? So yeah. Really, like, in terms of thinking back to, and we talked about biases on the last show, right? Like, I don't know if there's going to be a more dynamic edge rusher that I've evaluated coming out of college than Abdul Carter, right? So I look at that group and I'm like, that group seems absolutely terrifying. And then I think they did a good job of adding some depth pieces here this offseason with guys like Robinson, who was in Jacksonville last year, but he's like this good 5 technique with some pass rush upside. And I think about him next to Dexter Lawrence. I'm like, man, that could be a pretty devastating combination. So as of right now, like, that to me feels like the group that's going to be really dynamic. And then you brought in Darius Alexander also, who's kind of this hyper athletic, long from Toledo defensive tackle, like in the rotation there. So again, I think Philly's got some really good football players on the roster. I do think you're asking them to project in a way. And here I am talking about projection and Abdul Carter. But I think with Burns, I think he's probably, outside of Micah Parsons, maybe the best edge rusher in the division. And then you've got Dexter Lawrence. And then you've got all these really nice kind of athletic depth pieces around the interior. And I'm really going to bet on Abdul Carter to be good. And then you throw Kayvon Thibodeau as like your third guy, who was a former, was he top 10 pick? I don't remember.
He was top 5 pick. I think he was the 5th pick.
Yeah. So like, I don't know, man. Like, that feels like a really dynamic, deep group. And again, like, they were really productive last year. Like, they were crazy productive last year. So
yeah,
why would anything be different this year? And they've just gotten more talented, at least on paper.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think this is the best group in the division. And something that I should have said before we even dove into the D-line, just to take a step back real quickly, and had the perfect opportunity, Logan, because we were teasing the coaches show next week. But like, last year, remember, part of what made these rankings so difficult, especially the coach rankings, but also the defensive position group rankings, is we had no idea how anybody was going to get used, because all 4 defensive coordinators were brand spanking new. This year, you have Eberflus in Dallas, going back where he was the linebackers coach, you know, before he got his DC job in Indy and then the head job in Chicago. But other than that, everyone's back for their second year. So we have a much better idea schematically of how these guys are going to be used. Like Shane Bowen is still there in New York, and you know, we'll say what we think of Shane Bowen next week, but at least we know, like, okay, fundamentally Dexter Lawrence is going to do X for Shane Bowen, and Brian Burns is going to do Y for Shane Bowen, and we, the body types that he likes, the guys that succeed, the guys that don't. And when you look at what they've got, like, they've got high end guys like Lawrence, Burns, Carter, if he can produce as a rookie, and they have depth. They have guys, you know, down, you know, whether it's high upside depth like Alexander, or some guys that have a little bit more, you know, staying power in the league. Guys like Chauncey Golston is there on the outside. He's just like, you know, nondescript NFL pro, but like a pro. And there's a lot of those guys, in, obviously in Washington. Like, I do
like,
think
even New like York, Nunez Roches, you know what I mean? Like, he's been in the league for like 20 years. That's not a lie, but like 15 years, 12 years, something like that. And he's just a good, solid 4-eye.
Yeah. I mean, Elijah Chapman like made some plays for them last year. Like, I remember watching the Commanders games and be like, oh, that dude flashed. He's now a third string for them, a defensive tackle.
Yeah, no, and I even go down the list. Like, you got DJ Davidson, he's excellent. Elijah Chapman, did you just mention him? Like, he was awesome last year for them.
Yeah,
like,
he was great.
In terms of being explosive, dynamic, like in terms of line stunts, some of the stuff they were doing with him. So yeah, like, I don't know, man. Like, it just seems like they've got a lot of depth. Seems like that's the strength of the team. Seems like that's a strength of the position in the division. And I don't know. Like, it feels weird again. And maybe, and I'm kind of valuing Abdul Carter here in a very high way, but I just think if you put him as a true stand-up edge, the way he can drop, the way he can rush, the like, he had one of the best first-step get-offs I've ever seen in college. You know what I'm saying? And so, like, does that translate? I'm going to say yes. And so, I don't know, it just seems like they've got a lot of depth, a ton of depth, of like quality depth, and they've got some really high-end talent. So to me, this feels like the best group in the division.
Yeah, for sure. Then it becomes 2-3-4, obviously, and we haven't talked about Dallas or Washington at all yet. But to kind of circle back to Philly real quick, like, Carter, if it's not Lawrence, he's probably the best player in the division on the defensive side of the ball.
Or Micah
certainly
Parsons.
On the D line. I mean, oh yeah, I guess Parsons. Parsons, yeah. But Carter's awesome. He's a guy that could eventually make, like, you know, Miles Garrett's making like $40 million now. Like, is he one of, he and Micah are the next maybe $40 million defensive players, considering what the value that they bring, and the skill sets they bring. I think Nolan Smith is a really fascinating guy because he's thinner, you know, was he weigh like 240 as an edge?
Yeah.
People are like, oh man, he's just like, oh, and he runs a 4.3. So, you know, speed rusher. And it's like, that's actually not who he is at all as a player.
He's better run defender for sure.
He's a run defender and he's really, really, really good at it. And specifically in this division, the ability to chase down a mobile quarterback, namely Jaden Daniels, is a really important aspect. So even though he's not like a great pass rusher, his edge setting and his ability to maintain the pocket and keep control on, like, contain on the edge in a way that's a little bit different athletically is a really valuable skill. You combine that with Carter, Jordan Davis. And then the problem is, I think for Philly, is the depth kind of fades away. I mean, Hunt is obviously interesting. We'll see what Aziz Ojulari is, but that interior depth is not quite as strong as it has been. Unless some of these young guys pan out, I do think that Philly's probably earned the benefit of the doubt over the years when it comes to defensive linemen.
Sure.
I would trust that they probably have drafted well, and that one, two, or all of these guys are going to work out just fine.
Yeah, you know, like, and it's crazy because, like, I think Josh Uche is a good player. Like, he was in New England last year, like, very solid edge, kind of crafty rusher. Aziz Ojulari, we've talked about a lot. You know, he's in New York and, like, skilled. And, like, if you just want to rush the passer, like, that's what he'll be able to do for you. But it is weird looking at the roster, you know, looking at the depth chart here and kind of be like, man, there's no like established guy in the perimeter in the way that they've always had Brandon Graham. They've always had
I don't think we mentioned, like, Josh Sweat's departure is obviously an enormous thing here, him going to Arizona.
Yeah, and then, who was the guy that, I forget his name, that signed in Hassan Reddick. Yeah. Like, they've always had somebody on the perimeter that's been very productive, been established. And, like, even Brian Burns the specialty edge rusher from New York, the little short guy who didn't play for them. But, like, they've had guys that have been very productive over the course of their career. And then you're asking kind of some younger players who I think are good players. Like, I like these players a lot. Nolan Smith, Jalen Hugg, like, I like them a lot, but I do think there's a little bit of a developmental arc. And then you go to the interior and like Jordan Davis, I like what he does, but he's always a little bit inconsistent, you know, and I think that's something Philly fans have been very quick to kind of point out. And when you watch him, you're like, man, that, like, here's this crazy splash play where he's like forcing the pressure or he's splitting a double team and he gets quiet for a couple plays. And so can he achieve that level of dominance that I think a lot of people thought he was going to be the next Dexter Lawrence, right? And he has not played to that level. Obviously, Jalen Carter has been as advertised. Moro Ajomo, I like a lot as like a kind of rotational guy. He'll probably be their pass rush guy and sub, which I think is a nice way to kind of offset some of that, those interior departures. But it doesn't feel like it's got the same kind of teeth to it that it's had. I'm not saying it's a bad group, like, so right. Philly fans calm down, but like, does it have that dominant player to offset Jalen Carter, like to support him? And I think you're kind of relying on, again, Hunt and Smith to kind of take those steps, which is totally a reasonable expectation. But how does that compare to Dallas, you know, with Micah Parsons and some of those other guys that are really kind of more established, more consistent football players?
So speaking of, Dante Fowler returns to Dallas. He obviously had a monster production year, but is a complicated player beyond the stats. That he goes back to Dallas as a pass rush option for them. They lose Tank Lawrence in the offseason. He goes to Denver. Mozzie Smith was better in year two than year one. Year one was bad. Year two was fine. We'll see what he can be in year three. They re-sign Osia Digizua, who's a very, very good player on the interior. Obviously, Micah. They also draft or bring in Marshawn Nealand, or have Marshawn Nealand, I should say, that drafted last year. Solomon Thomas, the veteran, is there now as a backup on the interior. They draft Ezeraku as well, who obviously we spent a lot of time talking about. We thought he could be an option here as a pass rush kind of guy. This is an interesting group, because I think there are some really, you know, potentially, like, if Ezeraku hits, like, man, that's a steal guy considering what he was in college. Yeah. They've got, obviously, Micah. Dante Fowler in the right spot is a really, really, you know, dangerous player. But the thing is, like, he's currently listed as the guy starting opposite of Micah. Sure. And if Micah Parsons, now Micah, even though he's this pass rush maniac, is also a nasty edge setter. So, like, Micah being a starting defensive end is actually fine. Even if body type wise, he's quote unquote
right?
light. Like, it's like, oh, that's not what defensive ends look like. Oh, he plays like that.
Yeah.
Fine. Yeah. But Dante Fowler being opposite of that, that is interesting to me. And I also do wonder if, you know, it was one thing when Tank Lawrence, who was a big, like, prototypical, massive 4-3 defensive end, his nickname was freaking Tank. Like, when that's the guy that's opposite of Micah, how do offenses adjust now that they don't have to necessarily worry about that other side because they don't have that size on the opposite side? And are there some things they can do to try to temper Micah's impact, especially as a run defender, and not to mention, you know, some of the pass rush stuff that he's able to do and where he's always going to get extra attention?
Yeah, I just want to point out that they do have guys with some size there, like Peyton Turner. We saw him last year in New Orleans. He's like one of the freakier defensive end body types in the NFL. You know, he's like kind of the 35-inch, 6'6", 6'7", 280-pound guy that always seems to manifest out of New Orleans because they draft those guys at a high level. So, like, they could easily put him out there. And I don't think he's a great pass rusher, but I think on first, second down, when healthy, that's a big caveat with him. Like, he's a pretty, like, consistent player. Marshawn Nealand was a guy they drafted in the second round, if I'm not mistaken, who I loved coming out of Western Michigan, is that right?
Yeah, Western Michigan, second-round pick, 56
physical,
overall last
high
year.
Motor. So I think getting a guy like their depth there, again, is not bad. And I think I just want to point out another kind of sneaky signing or drafting of Jay Toya, who to me was the best run-stopping defensive tackle, nose guard-type player in the draft last year. You know, he's like 355. He's got short, stubby arms. He's kind of built like a fire hydrant. But out of UCLA, played a part of that great defense at UCLA. Like, so I think he could be an awesome kind of fit there to offset some of Mozzie Fist's deficiencies. However, after going through it a little bit, like, I do feel like the group in Philly is just way more consistently good. I think the floor for Philly is so much higher because of coaching, because of utilization, because of how they play just generally. Here, it just feels like a lot's got to come together. I'm not saying it won't, but you mentioned like Fowler, Peyton Turner, you're asking him to kind of exceed expectation. Marshawn Nealon, who I really liked in his limited snaps last year, again, is coming into a bigger role. What does that look like? You know, I think Jaw is probably going to play a lot for them in terms of run stopping downs on first, second down. Like, rookie player, Donovan Zeraku projection. Like, we loved him as a prospect, but it just feels like the ceiling is probably pretty high, but I think the floor is also pretty low. Much like we talked about their offensive line. Like, I feel really good about this group, but I think a lot of pieces kind of got to fit together in a way that Philly's defensive line, that's not really the case. Like, you know, Hunt is an excellent run defender on the edge. You know, Nolan Smith is an excellent run defender. You know, Jordan Davis is excellent in the run defense game. Mauro Jomo is excellent in the run defense. And so sometimes I think when you just have a solid run defending, physical, hard hat group, it just sets the table in a really nice way. And then on top of that, you kind of say to yourself, okay, there's some pass rush upside in here also. So I'm going to bet Philly here at 2 and probably go Dallas at 3 if I had to have had to categorize it.
So that leaves us with Washington.
Yeah.
And we have spent quite a bit of time, Logan Paulson, talking about the Washington Commanders defensive line this offseason. We like a lot of things that happened here, which I think is an important thing to say, because we talk about a solid run defense. It looks like they could have it. They shored up the edge with guys like Dietrich Wise, bringing back Cleveland Furl, who was good last year until he was hurt, and then he wasn't very good, but the injury clearly was having an impact. Dorrance Armstrong, obviously, he signed a 3-year deal when he signed, so he's back. And then, you know, Jalen Holmes, who played really well for them at times last year, and then they have all the girth inside with Payne. They signed Kinlaw, Jerzon Newton. They signed Eddie Goldman. They bring back Carl Davis and Sheldon Day. So Javonte John-Baptiste is another name that should mention. Like, that's a lot of dudes who are good NFL football players that they have. It's just that the upside is not necessarily there unless Newton takes a huge step or Payne plays at a level that he hasn't played at in a couple of years, especially or produces at a level he hasn't in a couple of years, or Kinlaw clicks. And it's just a lot of ors and a lot of what ifs. And considering the quality of the others in Dallas, you know, we talked about the what ifs, but like, they also have Micah Parsons. Right. Does that just by default leave Washington fourth?
I think when you were talking through it, I was like, well, what's really the difference between the two groups? And it's definitely Micah Parsons. It's like his ceiling and what he brings, his ability to create. Like, just watching those two, I went back and watched those two games from last year that Washington played against them. Yeah. His ability to just, like, kind of like take over a game, like the way like Kobe Bryant would, like isolation basketball, like I'm rushing over a guard, like good luck blocking me, or I'm going to beat this tackle. Like, his ability to create TFL sacks quick and the quick wins, like to not blitz the way they didn't like at points last year, and for him to create the pressure, I thought was really impressive. So I just wanted to say, like, I do think, like, I like Dorrance a lot. I think he's going to get about 10 sacks this year. Like, that's how confident I am he's going to play well, right? Deron, I think, is a really, really, really good football player. But is he an elite player the way some of those other interior players we talked about are? At this moment, no, right? I think Kinlaw has a tremendous ceiling. But has he done it recently? There's flashes of it, but not the consistency, right? Dietrich Wise, I think, is the most kind of consistent get-on-base selection at that left defensive end spot you could possibly want. But we're not talking about high-floor players here. We're talking about what's going to elevate the ceiling of this group. And when you compare it to, you know, some of these other edge rushers we talked about, like, I've been very open about how much I like Dietrich Wise. Like, he's going to get you 5 sacks this year, right? And he's going to play great run defense on first, second down. But, like, there's the ceiling isn't there the same way that it is with some of these other players. And so, yeah, Cleveland Farrell kind of in the same bucket. I think Eddie Goldman's a really sneaky addition, but he's a sneaky addition because he fills a certain type of role in this defense, right? So I think, like, that's where you say, like, you're banking on the oars, like a lot of projection from Jerzon, a lot of projection from Kinlaw. And if those guys hit, oh my gosh, like, watch out, we're going to be a pretty dominant group. But again, there's still, I think even if those guys playing at really high level football, I don't know if they have the ceilings of some of those other players we were just talking about, like Adigi Zua, for example. Like, I don't know if, you know, he's always kind of a 8-9 sack kind of guy, creates a ton of pressure in the backfield. Like, I don't know if there's a guy like that on the roster right now for the Washington Commanders. And we'll see. And I hope I'm wrong. And I hope that this staff does a good job getting the best out of him. But I do think the floor is improved. I don't know what the ceiling is for this group.
Yeah, I think the floor might be higher than Dallas's, because I think, like, still, if the Mozzie Smith thing doesn't work, Diggy Zua is a great penetrator, but, like, that's a very specific kind of player. And, you know, your guy out of UCLA is a rookie. Like, there's a chance that they just get run all over, right, straight up the gut again. And Micah becomes less effective because they're never in pass rush situations. There's only so much he can do as a run defender because it's a kind of a weak link type system. So there's a chance, obviously, that it doesn't go well. And I also think, like, the gap here isn't, like, New York is really, really good. The gap between, like, Philly and the, and kind of the guesswork between Philly, Dallas, Washington, I could see all three of those being in any of the spots by the end of the year. But I think if we're going into it and we're being honest with ourselves, despite the fact that this is a Washington Commanders podcast and we have spent lots of time talking about how we think they made smart, strategic moves that will help the defense as a whole this offseason relative to the other three, they're coming in at fourth.
And you took the words right out of my mouth. Like, I think this group is better. I think it makes the defense better, right? And I think ultimately, if you're better on first, second down, we've talked about this before, like, you are better on second and long. You're better on third and long. I think these are all good moves. But if you're just looking at the group in isolation and not in the context of the defense, not in the context of the offense that they're playing with, I think it's important just to kind of be like, hey, they might not be as talented as some of these other groups in the division. Because like you talked about, Micah Parsons is going to be probably the highest defensive paid player here very shortly, right? You know, Dexter Lawrence is, again, at times the best defensive player in the NFL. Jalen Carter, same thing. So there's lots of really uber talented people. And as of right now, the Commanders don't have that guy. But as we talked about, like, sometimes just playing great run defense and being where you're supposed to be is exactly what you need from the defense. And that might end up being valuable enough for this group.
There are three $30-plus million defenders in the division. The Commanders do not have one of them. And that is kind of how it ultimately comes down.
All right. When we get back, well, first of all, if you want to hear the linebacker and the defensive back rankings, check out Take Command this weekend. Wherever you get your podcast, just search Take Command. And there it'll be. Pick up, you know, 25 minutes in, 23 minutes in, and you'll basically pick up where we just left you off. Coming up next here live on The Hoffman Show. Let's do this, actually. We were going to talk about some of the Ace Bailey stuff, but Charles Allen, the D.C. City Council member, was on with Grant and Danny earlier this afternoon. Mark Ein was on with the Junkies this morning. And I think it is a better decision for us to talk about some of the RFK stuff. We had Flack on yesterday to talk about it. But with now stakeholders, including Mark Ein, a partial owner of the Commanders, and a D.C. City Council member chiming in, let's do that next, plus our weekend preview, even though Anthony's not here, still brought to you by nobody, is coming as well here on the Team 980. The Nationals are in Anaheim tonight, take on the Angels. Nats 33-48 on the season. Angels 40-40. Mystics a big win last night, powered by rookie Sonia Citron's 21 points. Double-double for Shakira Austin as well. They are going to watch the Dallas Wings and Paige Beckers take on a Caitlin Clark-less Indiana Fever tonight. And then tomorrow night, they get the second game of the back-to-back against Dallas. Mystics now 8-8, pulled back to 500 on the year. Ace Bailey, again, we're not going to talk as much about this today, but we will have more to say on Monday, and we'll probably hear from Ace Bailey because they're going to have a press conference this weekend. Bailey is going to report to the Jazz on Saturday, press conference to introduce him this weekend per the team. That is what's trending. I'm Craig Hoffman on the Team 980.